All right, open your Bibles to Psalm 63. If you're using the Bible that's under the seat, that's on page 567. Psalm 63, a psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah. O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water. So I have looked upon you in the sanctuary, beholding your power and glory. Because your steadfast love is better than life, my lips will praise you. So I will bless you as long as I live. In your name I will lift up my hands. My soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips when I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night. For you have been my help, and in the shadow of your wings I will sing for joy. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. But those who seek to destroy my life shall go down to the depths of the earth. They shall be given over to the power of the sword. They shall be a portion for jackals. But the king shall rejoice in God. All who swear by him shall exult. For the mouths of liars will be stopped. Let's think about the original context of this psalm for a moment. You'll notice the psalm actually has a title for us. It gives some directions for us on the title, A Psalm of David When He Was in the Wilderness of Judah. Now, if you're at all familiar with David and his life, what his life was like before he was king, after he was king, you know that he is no stranger to the wilderness. He fled to the wilderness many times in his times to escape from the previous king, King Saul. But the likely context of this psalm is when David was fleeing from someone who was much closer to him, his own son, Absalom. This particular time in David's life may have been David's lowest point ever. And it's during this low point David pens this psalm, giving us a snapshot of what he was going through and what he was thinking about at that moment. The story of this moment is pretty fascinating. If you want to read it, you can go to 2 Samuel 15 and read about it sometime. Just start in 2 Samuel 15 and read through a few chapters. It's basically a story of a political coup. David's son Absalom had convinced himself that he should be able to successfully steal the kingdom away from his father. So he spent 4 years secretly amassing wealth and a band of loyal followers to help him. He was stealthily turning the tide of popular opinion against David and to himself. And the text says, he stole the hearts of the men of Israel. He stole the hearts of the men of Israel. For years, he used every form of political maneuvering and manipulation right under David's nose. And then one day, he goes to, of all places, Hebron, the same place where David was crowned king. He takes hundreds of David's men with him, including one of David's highest-ranking advisors. And in a formal ceremony, he crowns himself. They crown Absalom, the new king of Israel. And then in a sort of PR maneuver, he sends out messengers to the elders and the heads of all the 12 tribes of Israel to announce this new kingship. David gets word of this, and he knows that he is about to go to war with his own son. So in order to protect Jerusalem from needless bloodshed, he flees the city. He gets out of there. He flees his own capital with a band of some of his most trusted warriors. And what happens at this moment is sort of interesting. The priests of the tabernacle, they see that David's leaving, and they go to leave with him. They pick up the Ark of the Covenant, and they go out of the city with it, with David. Now try to understand this, because the tabernacle was a very significant place for the Hebrews. It was the center of worship. It was where God's people would bring all their sacrifices and all their offerings to God. It was like a little mobile Garden of Eden, right there in the midst of the capital of Israel. The Ark was God's throne, the symbol of God's authority and his presence. So here come the priests. They're loyal to David. They're carrying the ark with them. Hey, the king of Israel is leaving, so we're going to take the throne of God and leave with him. And he says, carry the ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me see it and his dwelling place. But if he says, I have no pleasure in you, behold, here I am. Let him do to me what seems good to him. Notice the longing in David here. What he hates the most about having to leave his own political capital, what he hates the most about leaving the city is that he has to leave the place where God is worshipped. He has to leave the place where God himself is worshipped. At this point, David is really unsure about what he's going to do, about what's going to happen. Will he ever come back to the city as the king again? Will he ever go back to the tabernacle and worship again? Or will he be hunted down in the wilderness and killed? So David flees the city. He has this band of faithful soldiers with him. He waits by the fords of the Jordan for word about what's happening back in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, Absalom has come to the city with his whole entourage, and he has assumed control of the kingdom. And David is told by an informant that Absalom plans to gather men from all the tribes of Israel into an army in full force, march out into the wilderness, and hunt David down. So David and his men flee from the Jordan River to a city of refuge. And the text in 2 Samuel 17:29 says, it describes how David's men had become hungry and tired and thirsty in the desert. This is the setting of Psalm 63. It was penned in the midst of this turmoil. In fact, when David writes in this psalm that he is in a dry, it's like he's in a dry and weary land where there is no water. That word weary is the same word used here in 2 Samuel to describe David's company when they're arriving in the city. Their hurried escape through the arid desert had made them weary, and they are tired from all the dehydration and the heat. But I want you to notice what he does here in this psalm. David isn't writing about his physical thirst. Instead, he writes about something spiritual. He doesn't say, my body thirsts for refreshment, my flesh faints for water. He says, my soul thirsts for you, God. My flesh faints for you as in a dry and weary land where there is no water. His desert surroundings are more of a symbol to him for the state of his heart, for the state of his own soul. In this crisis moment, David yearns, above all things, for God. So, with that in mind, I want to consider three things that this psalm teaches us. Every good sermon has to have 3 points, so I've got three. Three things this psalm teaches us. First, what is a yearning for God? Second, how do we grow in our yearning for God? And three, how is our yearning fulfilled? What is a yearning for God? How do we grow in our yearning for God? Three, how is our yearning fulfilled? First, what is a yearning for God? What do we mean when we say we yearn for God? Well, the heart of this psalm is about one thing. It's about a longing to experience God in the place of worship. That's where David's left. He's left the place of worship, and he is a longing to return to it, to go back. David has a longing to experience God. This longing that he has is felt deep in his bones. As the American preacher Jonathan Edwards put it, this psalm is about religious affections. It's about the heart being deeply moved by thoughts of God. And David shares with us very helpful language to help us know what this means. So in a typical Hebrew fashion, David writes about his desire for God. He uses this language of the five senses. It's not uncommon in Hebrew poetry and Hebrew writing for writers to use vivid sensory language to describe something spiritual. It's an earthier language because it really helps us to understand what David is experiencing in this moment when he's talking about his yearning for God. Tim Keller notes that David uses three descriptions or three analogies for his yearning: thirst, sight, and feast. Thirst, sight, and feast. He writes, "My soul thirsts for you, my flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water." Now, I have never experienced thirst to the point of feeling like I was going to faint. I've never experienced that before. I know that when the body loses just 2% of its total fluid, dehydration symptoms will begin to show right away. Not just thirst, but dry skin, dry mouth, fatigue, chills, head rushes. If you lose more fluid, the body might experience an increase of heart rate, muscle cramps, nausea, tingling limbs, dim vision, delirium, and even seizures. And of course, if you don't have enough water, ultimately you could die. So when David says his flesh faints for God, it means his soul is longing for God so much, it's actually affecting him physically. The Bible loves this metaphor of thirst because it's a language of necessity, right? When we think of thirst, it's a language of necessity. The soul needs God like body needs the water. God speaks through the prophet Jeremiah saying, "My people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and he has hewed out cisterns for themselves, broken cisterns that can hold no water." What a vivid contrast between God, the creator of all things, and created things that we turn into little gods. Between the creator and created things, an ever-flowing spring of water that never runs dry versus a dry well. A spring and a dry well are similar in that they both look like they're going to quench your thirst. On the outside, a dry well just looks like a well that has water in it. When you get closer and you peer deep down into it, you discover that it's empty. That's what it's like when we worship created things, when we make created things more important than the Creator. In this text, God wants us to see several things. First of all, he wants us to know that our bodies, that our souls, not just our bodies, feel thirst. Our souls have a deep need and longings that can only be described, or that can be vividly described, as thirst, a real need for God. Second, he wants us to acknowledge him as the fountain of living waters, the only thing that will satisfy us. And the third thing he wants us to understand in this text is that as sinful people, we are well diggers. That's what sinful people do. Thirsty people, people with a real soul thirst, what they do is they dig wells. They find any place, any kind of place to dig a well. Maybe I'll find some water here. Maybe I'll find some water here in these little created things around me. We craft idols that we think are going to quench our thirst. We take good created things in this world and we craft them into essential, ultimate things, the most important thing to us. But in doing that, we find that we don't get the water that our souls need. David uses also the language of sight. He says, "I have looked upon you in the sanctuary, beholding your power and glory." David here is speaking not about his physical eyes, the eyes of the heart. He uses the same sort of language in Psalm 27. "One thing I have asked of the Lord, and that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and inquire in his temple." Now, there have been a handful of times in my life when I can honestly say that I have been to some place where I saw jaw-dropping beauty. I remember one time a few years ago when my family took a trip to the Badlands in South Dakota, and it feels almost cheap to put the experience of it into words. When we pulled our van off at this little overlook area and we could look out across and see the land just sort of fall away into these sedimented rocks that just seemed to sprawl for miles with all sorts of color everywhere. And I was gripped by it. I remember the feeling, that lump in my throat, the tears beginning to well up in my eyes as I looked at the beauty that was just too big for my soul to contain. It reminds me of my favorite novel by C.S. Lewis. It's called Till We Have Faces. It's a really good story. In the story, one of the main characters, her name's Psyche, is about to be taken on a journey to a great gray mountain. And she has never seen it up close. She's only seen it from the distance. And it's most likely that this character is going to die there. But she tells her sister about how she used to stare in wonder at that mountain. She says, "And because it was so beautiful, it set me to longing. Always longing. Somewhere else out there, there must be more of it. It almost hurt me. I felt like a bird in a cage when other birds of its kind are flying home. The sweetest thing in all my life has been the longing to reach the mountain, to find the place where all the beauty came from. To find the place where all the beauty came from. For David, he knows where that place is. He knows who it came from. God is the creator of beauty. So when David says he has seen God's power and glory, what he means is that his heart is actually being gripped by the beauty of who God is. So he uses the language of thirst and of sight, and finally he uses the language of feasting. My soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food. My mouth will praise you with joyful lips. I love this because what we see David doing here is he's tapping into his physical experience of hunger and redirecting those thoughts to God. He's tired. He's hungry. He's surrounded by men who are in the same boat as he is. He longs for the food to fill his belly, so he redirects his hunger to God and expresses this language of not just physical hunger, but spiritual hunger. When he talks about fat and rich food, the Hebrew words describe choice, flavorful meat, like a choice-grade, well-marbled steak. There is something about sitting down to a nice meal that is well-prepared, taking that first bite and savoring the flavor. And yet, David, in his spirit, in his experience of God, he says, like he says in Psalms 36, when he says of to God that the people feast on your abundance of your house and you give them drink from the river of your delights. When he thinks of God, he is filled with genuine delight. David has given us this language of thirst, of sight, of feast, to describe what it's like for him to yearn for God. In his heart, he feels a deep need for God. He thinks about the beauty of God, and he finds God deeply satisfying. But David doesn't stop there. Through this psalm, he models for us how we grow in our yearning for God. David doesn't just say, hey, I long for God, this is what it's like. He actually describes for the reader, how that longing was fostered. Anytime you read the Bible, it's really important to look at the connection words, to look at the logic of the text. In other words, to look for how ideas are connecting to each other. David describes his praise of God in verse 5, my mouth will praise you with joyful lips. But what led him to that praise? In verse 6, when I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night. Remember, David's on the run. He's with his soldiers. They've set up an encampment in the desert. David is wide awake. He's taking a shift on the night watch. The desert wind is blowing. It's dark, it's quiet, and the only thing David can hear in that moment is the sound of his own thoughts. It's at this moment that David meditates on God. What races through your mind at night when you can't sleep? What do you think about in your daydreams during the day? What are your daydreams like? Do you think about your work, your hobbies, your to-do list, your favorite TV show, the latest movie you saw, the book you're reading, your failures, your fears, the latest accomplishments, a special person in your life? Those might be fine things to think about, but it's at this dark moment in David's life when he purposes to remember God. He says he meditates on God. I love what Archbishop William Temple said. He said, your real religion is what you do with your solitude. Your real religion is what you do with your solitude. In other words, it doesn't matter what you say you believe. In your solitude, when you don't have anything to do, when your mind doesn't have, when you have nothing on your plate at that moment, and all is quiet, where does your mind habitually go? What do you daydream about? William Temple says, whatever that is the thing that can become so easily an idol to you. Your religion is what you do with your solitude. David says he meditates on God. Now, in the Bible, meditation is not like the Eastern variety. When I was in college, I went to a state-funded liberal arts school in Ohio, and I was getting my undergrad degree in religion and philosophy. So it's a miracle that I'm employed. And I was decided I was going to try to take, I was looking at a sample of classes to take for the semester, and I saw an Eastern meditation class. I was like, well, that'll be interesting. I wonder what that's like. I thought I was going to be studying, you know, history of it or something like that. And we get there, and I get there, and it was a three-hour, once-a-week class learning about meditation. Literally, what it meant was sitting down for about 3 hours with the teacher telling us to think about nothing. And then he'd ding a little bell, and he'd say, okay, how you doing? Did you think about nothing? Okay, good. Let's do that again. And we'd just keep going for like 3 hours. I dropped that class. I repented and said no more. But the meditation in the Bible is not the Eastern variety. The goal is not emptying the mind. In the Bible, the word meditate literally means to mutter, to mumble, to chew, to almost mull over something under your breath, to really study something. In other words, it's to fill the mind with one dominating thought. Or as David uses the same term in Psalm 143, I remember the days of old, I meditate on all you have done. So this is really good practical advice here. How do you meditate on God? How do we meditate? We think deeply on what God has done. I love how concrete this is. By simply using our imaginations, we can picture the things that God has done in the past, and that becomes sort of a window through which we can see the invisible God. For example, when we think about all the things He's created in nature, the sun, the moon, the stars, the trees, the mountains, the oceans, we can meditate on how God is the maker of all things. Which means God Himself is not a created being, but the creator and the sustainer of the whole universe. Which means He exists outside of the confines of space and time and change. This means He's infinite, He's eternal, He's absolute, He has no sways of or changes of emotion, He's almighty. When we remember the things that He's done in history, all the prophets He's sent, the patriarchs He's given promise to, the seas He has divided, and especially all the things He's done through Christ. We can meditate on His wisdom, His sovereign control, His mercy, His goodness, His justice, His forgiveness. Picture the things God has done. So here's David's secret. It's now an open secret. He's penned this for the children of Israel to read and sing aloud in the temple. So they understand this. What keeps him steady in the midst of the chaos is this habit of meditation. David could be obsessing over 1,000 things right now in these night watches. I mean, think about it. His own son has betrayed him. His trusted advisor has conspired against him. His men are restless and hungry. His kingdom and authority are crumbling. At any moment, an army bent on his death could appear out of the darkness in the wilderness and take his own life. And nobody in this room and nobody anywhere would fault David for obsessing over any one of those things. He could be fretting about any of these things, but David has developed this discipline of mind called meditation. He knew how to set apart his daydreams and his restless nights to God. Or as he says in verse 8, my soul clings to you. I love what the King James Version says, or how it translates this, my soul followeth hard after thee. That's a great translation. The word used here in the Bible, it's the same word to describe the way a man and a woman cling to each other in physical intimacy. It's the same word to describe how in warfare, one army will be on the hot on the trail of another army. It's the same word used to describe the way a thirsty tongue clings to the roof of your mouth. It's a word of feverish clinging, and that's what meditation is. It's a mind fixed on God that leads to this deep and satisfying worship. This sort of discipline of meditation and personal worship does not mean that we just sort of float above our circumstances like some kind of detached mystic. Far from it. It equips us to live right in the thick of life and yet to still have peace. to still have peace because our soul is anchored in someone who is immovable in all the chaos. So far, the psalm has showed us what a yearning for God is. In other words, it's a deep need for God, it's being wowed by the beauty of God, and it's finding God deeply satisfying. Thirst, sight, and feast. It also showed us how to grow in our yearning for God through meditation. And finally, it shows us how our yearning is fulfilled. It's all well and good to say that God created us to yearn for Him, but how is that longing ever satisfied? The last three verses of the psalm might seem a little bit out of place. Maybe you noticed that when I read the psalm aloud, but they're actually the key to the whole psalm. In these verses, David expresses confidence that although he is on the run for his life, there are those who are hunting him down. Those people will ultimately fail. He says to those trying to usurp the throne that they will not be successful. Their lying mouths will be stopped and they will die in battle. In verse 11, he says, the king, that is himself, shall rejoice in God. And everyone who's truly devoted to God will be overjoyed by the king's victory. By the way, after David wrote this psalm, these things literally did happen. 20,000 of Absalom's men would die in battle. Absalom himself was killed. And the rest of the military trying to find him, they fled to their homes. The rebellion against David was over. And so he returned to the city and, best of all, returned to the sanctuary where he loved to worship God. The million-dollar question is, in the wilderness, what gives David this kind of confidence? That's the million-dollar question. What gives David this kind of confidence? Well, he drops little hints in the psalm for us. He says things like, "You have been my help," and "Your steadfast love is better than life." This is a word you've probably seen. This word is used a lot in Scripture. It means loving kindness, or a better translation of it is God's faithful love, God's ruthless loyalty, His loyalty to His people. Years before, the prophet Nathan came to David, and he had a special message from God for him. You can read about it in 2 Samuel 7. God promised David that he would make David's name great, giving him a throne that would be established forever. He says that although he would discipline his heirs to the throne, although he would discipline David's sons and grandsons and great-grandsons, all who would sit on the throne, he says, "My steadfast love will not depart from him." My steadfast love will not depart from him. My faithful love will never depart from him. My ruthless loyalty will never depart from him. God made David and his descendants a promise, and God will not fail to keep that promise. For David's own immediate situation, he knows that this means that Absalom's rebellion will ultimately fail. No matter how bleak things look at that moment for David, David's throne is not going to be taken. He will return to Jerusalem again and worship God. He will go back to the place where he feels that deep need for God, where his desire for God is, God's beauty is fulfilled, where his longing for God is satisfied in his presence. He knows that he will be back in Jerusalem again to worship God. But this special covenant, this special promise that God gave to David has implications for all in David's line. It means yes, of course, God will discipline his people. God will discipline the kings of his chosen nation. And sometimes that discipline is going to be pretty severe, as the history of Israel shows us. But it also means that David's dynasty will never ultimately die. And someday, God will establish his king over the entire world. The good news is that from our vantage point, this promise is already fulfilled. This promise is fulfilled. About 1,000 years after David's time, a boy was born in the family line of David, in the very same town where David himself was born and raised, in Bethlehem. This boy would grow up and stun all of Israel with his power. When blind men would cry out to him, "Son of David, have mercy on us," he would heal them of their blindness. When he drove out demons, the crowd would say, could it be that this is the Son of David? Even those outside Israel, they sought him for healing, saying, have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David. And he would heal them with miraculous power. This man was Jesus. And if it wasn't enough that Jesus showed authority over sickness and all the powers of hell, he even shows his authority over death itself by rising from the grave. Now, I want you to think about this, because not in David's wildest dreams could he have imagined how God was going to fulfill his promise to him. Think about it. The divine Son of God, though he is in the form of God, and though he is the radiance of God's glory, actually entered into David's bloodline. The eternal Son of God took on human form. He took a human nature so that he might be the perfect person to go between the eternal God and us. As Paul later wrote of Jesus, that he was descended from David according to the flesh, that is, that's the family he was born into, and he was declared to be the Son of God in power according to the Spirit of holiness by his resurrection from the dead. That's who Jesus is. Two natures, one human, one divine, unmixed, inseparable in one person. And right now, as I speak, as we sit in this room today, seated at the right hand of God the Father in the heavenly realms is a human, a descendant of David, sitting on the highest throne in the whole universe. A human being with the blood of David running in through his veins. How is our yearning for God fulfilled? How is our yearning for God fulfilled? How is David's yearning fulfilled? Well, in one sense, it's partially fulfilled, well, right in the here and now. We call on Christ as Lord as we meditate on the things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Then our longing for God is fulfilled. But in an ultimate sense, our longing for God is fulfilled when the man who sits on David's throne returns and consummates this kingdom. Then we're going to drink of God deeply, and our thirst will be quenched. Then we will see God's beauty, and we'll never grow tired of it. Then we will be satisfied with God in a feast that never ends. Psalm 63. This whole ordeal began when David was fleeing the city with his men. The Bible says that David ascended a slope of a tall hill in Jerusalem called the Mount of Olives. This is a picture of the view from that mountain today. In the text, David wept as he went up this hill. He and his men covered their heads and walked barefoot up the hill, which back then was a sign of public grief and mourning. And from the summit of the Mount of Olives, he could look back over the city of David and mourn as he thought about the gravity of the situation he was in. Most of all, the gravity of having to be away from God's sanctuary. Little did he know that centuries later, on that exact same mountain, one of his own descendants would stand there looking over Jerusalem again. On there, the Mount of Olives, instead of weeping as he went up that hill, that resurrected descendant of David would lift up his hands, bless those who were with him, and be carried up into heaven. David stood on that hill, fearful of what he was about to lose, that he was about to lose his throne. But the Son of David lifted off from that mountain to be seated on the highest throne in the universe. David stood on that mountain troubled that he might never again see God's earthly sanctuary. But the Son of David lifted off from that mountain into the joy of God's heavenly sanctuary. That was when the Son of David, the true, ultimate Son of David, could pray the final verses of this psalm. The king shall rejoice in God. And he has gone there to prepare a place for us so that we might share in his joy. Amen.